And the title of my talk is Tensor Network and in brackets, phiatic ADS-CFT. And the reason for putting phiatic in a bracket is that the first part of my talk, I'll talk about something that I think is correct for an arbitrary tensor network. But in order to make things concrete, we'll see that if we put this tensor network on the so-called BT tree, we could actually reproduce exactly some of the properties of the phiatic ADS-CFT correspondence that is recently studied by Steve Gupta and another group whose name I couldn't pronounce in Caltech. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Let me start. So the overview of my talk is that we have already heard some beautiful review of tensor network and ADS-CFT. So I will start right into the meat of asking to motivate what we were trying to do. I'll start with talking about the HKLL relation, and the goal was to understand how some of the details of the HKLL relation is actually recovered in the tensor network. And then we'll see that by doing that, we are automatically defining some interacting theory that propagates in the graph that defines this bulk, emergent bulk space. And finally, I'll talk about how putting our graph in this BT tree, we are realizing, it appears that we are realizing many parts of the ADS-CFT dictionary of the phiatic ADS-CFT. So let's start. One reason that the tensor network get associated with the ADS-CFT correspondence was because of Brian's observation, this prescient observation that the entanglement entropy of the tensor network, the way we compute entanglement entropy in the tensor network looks closely related to the root Takanagi formula. So that has been reviewed in many previous talks. I'll not go over that again. But so there were a couple of explicit proposals for realizing realizing the relationship between ADS-CFT and tensor networks. And these proposals include for example, the happy code and Xiaoliang's and collaborators' bidirectional holographic codes and random tensor network. And some of the key ingredients that went into this proposal is, first of all, we want to reproduce the root Takanagi formula. And secondly, it seems to reproduce observations that is inspired by the so-called HKLL formula, where the HKLL formula, as I'm going to review shortly, is about reconstructing bulk operator in terms of boundary operators. And it is from the HKLL formula that we know, by now we know that we only need a subregion in the boundary to recover the bulk operator. How does this bulk operator reconstruction practically works? So basically, for example, in the perfect tensor codes, if I start with some bulk operation somewhere in the interior of the tensor network, and I add the interior link with some operator sigma, then it is equivalent to some other operators acting on the other side. So this operation, the blue operation here, is equivalent to the red operation here. And so you could keep pushing the operation, whatever operation that you have in the bulk, towards the boundary. And so this procedure of operator pushing is practically how the HKLL relation is realized. But let's pause. But that is one thing that has been bothering me a lot when I look at this operation. And this was the motivation of scrutinizing this operation closely. What bothers me is that it is actually not hard to prove that if you start with perfect tensors, and if you have some operator acting here, then it always involves at least exactly, if they're all together L legs in a perfect tensor, then this operator pushing always involves taking, let's say, one tensor on one side of this tensor. It always gets pushed into at least L operators acting on the other side. So if there are two L legs, there are six legs, then the other side always involves all three legs non-trivial. And this you could prove that is true for any perfect tensor and for any bond dimension. So we included that proof in the appendix of our paper. And what bothered me is that there's something that we know about the HKLL relation. And the HKLL relation in the ADS-CFT has a statement that says, in the leading large N limit, if I have some bulk operator, it is related to some boundary operator. That much is fine, and that this set of boundary operators don't necessarily involve all the operators in the entire boundary. That is also fine. But it seems that the HKLL formula has some extra information there. And this extra information is in this smearing function. So in the perfect tensor construction, we haven't said anything specific about the smearing function. But in the ADS-CFT dictionary, there is something specific about it. And for example, at least in the causal reconstruction, exactly as in the original proposal of HKLL, we know that the smearing function is a solution of the ADS equations of motion. And the mass is specific. It is related to the conformal dimension of the boundary operator in some very specific way. So delta plus is the conformal dimension. And the smearing function in Poincaré coordinates, for example, takes this very specific form, where we have delta minus here, and delta minus is equal to d minus delta plus. And it corresponds to the normalizable modes of the equations, of the Klein-Gordon equation. And as we know, the delta plus, there's another delta plus solution which takes almost the same form, which corresponds to non-normalizable modes, and that corresponds to putting sources at the boundary. So these are some information that we know from ADS-CFT, but it's not immediately apparent how we could recover these information from the perfect code. And precisely because if you have this big product when you push across a tensor, then when you get to the boundary, when you reconstruct this bulk operator at the boundary, it always involves basically a huge product of operators at the boundary. And it is not clear whether I could get something that looks like a linear sum of operators. And so that was one motivation of studying this in closer, putting this to closer scrutiny. So the question was, I want to reconstruct an operator, and I want to push the operator across a tensor. So let's step back a little bit, and let's for the moment give up perfect tensors and ask, what do I generally expect when I push an operator across a tensor? So here, So suppose, let's consider a three-leg tensor. And I want to push things across it. So let's say I have an O here, and I want to ask, what is it when I push it to the other side? So in general, if I'm not working with the perfect tensor, then I would expect that this is equal to some big linear combination of, so if I start with some operator A, it would be some big linear combination of operators OB and OC. Right. If I want to write it more specifically, in fact, I would get something like the following in general. So where I have OB non-trivial, and this is 1, plus alpha A 1B, where I have 1 here, OB here, plus alpha A non-trivial on both legs. So if this were not a perfect tensor, then I would generally expect that if I have some operator acting here, it is equivalent to having some other operators acting on the other side. This is precisely the operator reconstruction that we have been talking about in the previous slides, except if we're not working with a strictly perfect tensor, then in general, we would expect some other terms that might be linear on the other side of the tensor. So practically, how do I solve for these numbers given a tensor? The idea is that you could just put here, you could just put here an identity operator, but at the same time, I could replace this identity operator by assuming that there exists an inverse to this operator. Then I could just sandwich. I insert an identity, but I split that identity into the tensor itself and its inverse. And so what I'm trying to say is practically, you could solve for all these coefficients that I'm talking about by sandwiching whatever operator with the inverse of the tensor and the tensor itself. So this would allow you to solve for these non-trivial coefficients that I was talking about. Is that clear at this point? Okay. So what good are they for? What good is that these coefficients are? What are they good for? So for simplicity, let's look at a tree graph. So that was where we started this exercise. So imagine I have some operator acting on this leg, and I want to push the action of this leg to the boundary. So everything goes like the perfect code, but I want to ask the question that is analogous to what how we do things in the ADS-CFT correspondence, and that is I want to ask whether I could extract the coefficient of a linear operator that contributes to this big mass when I reconstruct this operator. I want to extract the linear term. So if I want to extract, so in particular, let's focus on this particular operator that sits at this length at the boundary, what would be the coefficient of this operator contributing to this bulk operator? Clearly, if using this set of coefficients, what I want to do is I want to push this operator across this node, but at each point when I push across each node, I would only want to pick up the linear term. I don't want to pick up all these quadratic terms, because if at any point on this tree I pick up a splitting of this operator, then I would get multiple operators at the boundary. And so naturally, when I'm dealing with, I'm asking for this linear coefficient, then I would just pick up this linear term across every node. And so at the end of the day, I'm just going to get a product of this matrices, of this alpha matrices, and this alpha matrices go through the path that connects the operator in the bulk and the boundary operator. So when I see this kind of equation, then it is very natural that I want to diagonalize it, assuming that this is some homogeneous tensor network where all the tensors take the same set of values. So it is natural that I want to diagonalize this matrix, and then this coefficient at the boundary, if I started with an eigen basis in the bulk, I would start to collect a lambda I to the power d, where d is the length of this path that connects the bulk operator and the boundary operator. So this is all very simple, but what is nice about that is that it is something, it is concretely the solution of a graph Klein-Gordon equation. So we start to get something that looks extremely similar to what we know in the ADS-CFT correspondence. So in case you're not completely familiar with the definition of the graph Laplacian, it's basically defined as the average of phi evaluated at all the neighbors of some given vertex V subtracted by the value of phi evaluated at V. And so it happens that if I have a function that is equals to some number, so what we will call that p to some power delta minus for later purposes, to some power d, where d is the distance between two vertices v1 and v2, this is a solution of this equation, where this is a massive Klein-Gordon equation, and that the mass is dependent on this delta in the following way. And in our case, this delta or p to the minus delta minus that we have defined is dependent on the eigenvalues that we have solved, the eigenvalues of this alpha that is completely determined by the tensor that we put into the network. So at this point, we get a sort of nice picture that suppose I have some CFT, I try to write down a mirror or tensor network state for my CFT, and then I use numerical methods to minimize the energy, which fix all the values of my tensors. Then it seems that it would tell me what are the bulk fields that propagate in this graph, and that it would so it determines a set of field contents in the bulk. So the discussion that I have just talked about actually generalized to a graph with loops, and so in that case, what you have to do is that first there's some detail that you have to define a flow. This kind of irrotational conserved flow is something that is discussed, for example, in the Happy paper and Xiaolang's paper. But barring this detail, the Green's function in the case when with a graph with flow, which corresponds to basically the same lambda to the power dp, where p is now the different paths that connect your bulk point to the boundary point. And this is, again, a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation in this general graph with loops. So far, we have been restricting our attention to the linear term in the tensor. And so the question is, what exactly are those nonlinear terms doing? And so then you ask the next question. If I have two operators at the boundary, that would also contribute to the bulk operator when I try to push all the operators into the boundary. But now it is pretty obvious what we want to do. We have to push, if I have exactly two operators at the boundary, then I want to push that operator, split it at a particular vertex, and then beyond that vertex, I want to keep, I don't want to split anymore because I want to keep myself having exactly two operators. And now the contribution at the boundary would then correspond to something that looks extremely like a Witten diagram that we're familiar with. And that is, you have some Green's function, now we could safely call it a graph Green's function, that propagate from the bulk vertex to the splitting vertex. Then this nonlinear coefficient here, that I called beta in this slide, tells me how this operator splits into two. And then finally, we use again the graph Green's function to propagate it all the way to the boundary. And so not only do the tensors tell us what is the field content, what are the masses of the scalar fields in the bulk, it also tells us how they interact. It also gives us interaction vertices in the bulk. So this is only for tree graph. And again, if you start dealing with loop graphs, then you could also define, you could also ask or solve for these coefficients where two operators, when they push across a node, comes back to one. And then you will find that in general, you get loop corrections. And so you can set up a systematic, the systematics of computing the boundary operator contribution to the bulk operator. And the systematics looks exactly like what we know in ADS CFT. Yes.
Can you contrast, are you getting Witten diagrams or are you getting the OB expansion in the CFT?
So here I'm just asking, well, what happens to my bulk operator as boundary operators? If I want to start talking about OPE, then in general I have to talk about correlation functions at the boundary and then put this operator close to each other. So this is an opposite process where I have to push things back into the bulk, and this is something that I'm going to talk about. So in general, these interaction vertices, I don't want to call them OP coefficients, but you could see that they are closely related. And so just a quick summary of what we have done. We see that as far as bulk operator reconstruction is concerned, actually, for pretty general tensors, if you don't restrict yourself to exactly perfect tensor, but for pretty perfect tensors, for pretty general tensors, the systematics of bulk operator reconstruction actually looks very similar to what we know in the ADS-CFT. And now you could start asking yourself questions like, when is it possible, how do I control the values of this tensor such that there is big mass gaps in the bulk, and how do I control the interaction vertices such that the bulk quantum field theories look almost free? So this becomes questions that you could answer very concretely in a given tensor network. And one other extra lesson that I have learned in this exercise is that, so what exactly are time-like versus space-like directions? So if you look at these solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, let's say in pure ADS, we know that the time-like and space-like directions really differ by you can go between time-like and space-like, or Lorentzian and Euclidean spaces simply by doing simply by doing analytic continuation of the momenta and you could go between ADS and DS by analytically continuing the masses, and you could see that in this picture all of those things are encoded in the eigenvalues of the tensor. So you're basically controlling. In some sense, you can control whether you are propagating in a time-like or space-like direction by changing the eigenvalues, the values of these tensors. Let us move on to the p-adic ADS-CFT. What about that? So one thing that we try very hard to do is to write down. Is to actually have some concrete expressions, compute correlation functions in this kind of states. But one difficulty of dealing with generic tessellations in ADS is that it is extremely hard to talk about wave functions that lives on a generic tessellation. And so that was one reason why we turned our attention to the so-called p-adic ADS-CFT. So instead of working with a real CFT, we deal with instead this so-called p-adic CFT, where the symmetry is no longer the usual conformal group, but instead it's the so-called SL2QP group that is where QP is the so-called p-adic field. And so the boundary theory in this case would live instead of in the real space, let's say in one dimension, one-dimensional boundary, the boundary is no longer living on the real line, but instead on this so-called p-adic field. And the p-adic field, roughly speaking, you could understand a p-adic number as an infinite expansion expressed in terms of some prime number p. Let me not go into that, but one very interesting observation about the p-adic numbers is that it satisfies the so-called idyllic structure, and I believe that is one of the motivation why Gupsa and company studied the p-adic version of the ADS-CFT, which basically says you can recover the real, so there's something called the p-adic norm, and the idyllic structure basically says if you take products instead of sums of this discrete objects, somehow they would the product of these discrete objects would recover the continuous limit, but then of course in practice it is not exactly clear how this relation would directly allow you to start from a p-adic CFT to go to real CFT, but the hope is based on this idyllic structure, and so now the analogy goes as follows. So you have the boundary theory lives on the p-adic line QP. So you and this is the bulk geometry that corresponds to that is an analog of ADS space, and even though QP itself is really it's not a discrete field, it just happens that the bulk, this bulk is so-called Bruchhaus-Titt tree. It's the so if the upper half plane or ADS2 is the coset of SL2R, the conformal group, the coset of SL2R by SO2R, then the Bruchhaus-Titt tree is really also a coset group. Is also a coset. It's just that after doing the coset, the bulk becomes a discrete tree, becomes a discrete object. And you could understand this tree basically as I draw it in the horizontal direction, that is the QP direction. And in the vertical direction, you could think of that as the Z coordinate. And it is basically specifying the accuracy of this p-adic expansion that I was discussing at this part of the slide. It is telling you that if I truncate this expansion to some powers p to the power m, then that cutoff surface would correspond to some. So yeah, if I truncate it at p to the 1, then it basically stops here. So is that clear how roughly to understand that picture? So every p-adic number would correspond to a path in this tree, depending on whether which coefficient you choose at every order in the infinite p expansion. So if I put now imagine I put tensors on the tree, then immediately easy to convince yourself that the, whatever that we have gone through in the first half of our of my talk basically goes through into this tree. And now, if I talk about HKLL relation that is defined on this BT bulk, then it would I could start. I would automatically get linear contributions that are solutions to the bulk Klein-Gordon equation, and I could read off the masses of the fields and all the interaction vertices on this tree. And so that is one side of the story. And now the second side, which is really important to us, is the isometry. So one reason for working with the p-adic tree was that, as I mentioned, we have complete control of the symmetry. In particular, SL2QP acts transitively on this tree. So in the previous slide, if you remember, I refrained from talking about delta minus. I refrained from calling that something directly related to conformal dimension. And the reason is I don't know what is conformal symmetry in a general graph, in a general tessellation. It's very hard to pin down. It's not even clear that dilatation is preserved in a particular tessellation of the ADS space. Whereas in this case, I could talk about dilatation, and I could talk about every single symmetry transformation inside the SL2QP. In particular, there is an analog of the dilatation symmetry that can be realized in this tree. It corresponds to, so the analog of dilatation works out quite interestingly. It corresponds to sliding this tree down this so-called main branch. And practically, so imagine I have a cutoff in this tree that stops at some accuracy. Then what does that tell me? It tells me that as I move from site 2 to site 4, as this line in site 2 slide down here, and it corresponds to the outermost layer at the cutoff surface, the distance of the outermost layer from the main branch increases. And so it is very suggestive that if I want to compute operator dimension, I should start talking about so if I want to compute a correlation functions in this state, then it suggests that the dilatation indeed corresponds to sandwiching an operator by an extra layer of these tensors, so So because of the precise way that the isometry for dilatation work, it is very suggestive that if I want to compute primary operators corresponding to the p-adic CFT, I should look for I should have a self-similar relation that looks like the following, where if I sandwich an operator by an extra layer of tensor, I get back a tensor that acts only on one link. And so one thing that is pretty interesting at this point, that is, I have some tensors here. So here, it would, if I diagonalize this matrix gamma, it would give me some basis for primary operators. But at the end of it, in the previous part, I have already talked about HKLL relation, where I'm reconstructing some bulk operator in terms of boundary operator, and that gives me a separate basis that diagonalizes those matrices alpha. And I could prove that in the limit where when the interaction is small, when the interaction is negligible, then I would recover a relationship of this sort. And this relationship is nothing but delta plus delta minus equals D. And so it seems that on this tree, I could recover another piece of the ADS-CFT correspondence where normalize the relationship between normalizable modes and non-normalizable modes behave in exactly the way as we know it. Then let's compute correlation functions. So if I want to compute correlation functions, this story, I believe, is completely familiar to the mirror community, where if I have some operator insertion O1 and O2, then I and on the other side I have to put in the complex conjugate on the other side, sandwiching these two things, and so using this self-similar structure, then it is quite obvious that the two-point functions would correspond to collecting these gamma matrices along the path until they meet at some point. And what is nice here compared to the usual tensor network story is that because this tree carries exact SL2QP symmetry, the correlation function that is computed this way is exactly the what we know to be the correlation function in a p-adic CFT. So this object is the p-adic norm and defined. I forgot to talk about it clearly, but it's just a detail. But what I'm trying to convey here is that now when you compute correlation functions on this tree using this simple rule, you recover exactly the correlation function of a p-adic CFT. And this program, you could generalize it to three-point function, four-point function, and now you can read off, fusion of matrices, but now it is in terms of this gamma rather than in terms of this alpha. So, and also, what is pretty nice about four-point functions is that you can see that there are some tree diagrams with some, sorry.
I just want to make sure, this is in two dimensions, right? So
that very good. Yes, it's something that I want to avoid talking about because the reason is it confused me. I've been talking about this as if it is a state, as if there is no time. But what I have really reproduced are relations where this is a Euclidean version of ADS2 CFT1, and so I don't have a if you're interested, I will tell you some. Rationalization of what I'm doing, but let's put it this way: at this point, if you take this prescription, you would get the ADS-CFT dictionary. A large part of it, some parts of the Witten diagram rules is slightly different about where the vertices have to be integrated over. That some detail is slightly different, but then the difference is interesting. In that, suppose if you compute four-point function, for example, it automatically arranged in a form that is identifiable as some conformal blocks decomposition without further work. This is some work in progress, but we could talk about that.
Sorry.
Yes, but then Gupso has a generalization to arbitrary dimensions, which I also forgot to mention. So the way he generalizes it is to start from QP and turn it to QPN. so that every tensor becomes, so in a p-adic tree, it has p plus one legs. And in d dimensions, so what is called n is my d, in d dimensions, it would have p to the n plus one legs, and my relationship would go through, and so it would recover that relation in arbitrary dimensions. So n is d, sorry. Yeah. So let me call that d. Right, so how much time do I have?
Or?
Oh, okay. So let me just summarize. I hope that in this talk, I have tried to show you that perhaps some more detailed dictionary in the ADS-CFT can in fact be visualized in the tensor network, and it actually appears to come out quite naturally. It seems to be defining some interacting field theory in the bulk. So far, we have only really worked with scalar fields, but it looks like the construction that we have is very friendly to generalizing to fermions and also gauge fields. But for spin two fields, it's harder because we don't understand how diffeomorphism works, but precisely for in the talk of Xiaoliang, he discussed how global symmetry can be understood as gauge theories in the bulk. And so you could actually we tried to look at HKLA relations in those cases as well, and it seems that it would work through quite generally. It would have the structure that as we understand it in the usual version of ADS-CFT. And so there are some other interesting questions apart from generalizing to more fields, is that now if we look into large bond dimensions, we could study these things by random tensors. So one set of questions that you could ask is under what circumstance? Because now you could actually solve for the masses and the interaction vertices in the theory, you could really ask yourself, under what circumstance is it a typical theory when I have large bond dimension that I get large gap and weak interaction? So this is something that we are also looking at the moment. We don't have a conclusive we are not completely conclusive about that, but it appears that because we're confused about normalizations, but it appears that it is true that it is something that is typical. But it's not conclusive yet. So let me end here. Thank you.
I think you can prove that there is a large gap. In general, that's the case for random tensor network with a special case. I thought that it's, if we choose random tensor, this is strongly interacting rather than weakly.
Oh, it's
The bulk theory, the weakly.
So when we try to compute so it's these numbers. So when we compute it, we're not entirely sure how to normalize these operators. And if it looks like if I normalize these things by D itself, then interaction vertices are always weaker than this. So this is what confused us.
So, Janet, I know this is not the point of your talk, but you know, working with three tensor networks is the dream of everybody who works with tensor networks, because it makes things much, much easier. And what I wanted to understand is there are these p-adic conformal theories
right.
that are naturally expressed with three tensor networks.
Right.
What can we learn by studying those conformal
right. it is
theories
a dream.
About the other?
Right. It is the dream in the 80s. So I forgot to mention that it was an observation by Wickham in the 80s that when he looked at usual string amplitudes, he find that using the adelic structure that I mentioned at some point, he could decompose a string usual string amplitude into products of p-adic amplitudes.
Yeah.
And so the hope was, if I don't know how to deal with the real case, I could deal with this simpler version of a CFT and somehow take products of them, and that recovers the real CFT. So in particular, there are lots of virtues of this phiatic CFT. For example, it doesn't have any descendants, so the constraints on the fusion rules are so much simpler. It only has primaries, and so. Things are very simple, and so that was the hope, and that I would suggest you a reference that is cited in Gupta's paper, Phiatic ADS CFT. It is also a paper in the 80s where he showed how you can decompose general minimal model into phiatic minimal models, taking products of them. But he had there's some problems in his paper. So this decomposing of minimal model is not Witten's paper, it's someone else. But this reference is in Gupta's paper that I should show here. It's very interesting. But his construction has some problems, and he has to tweak it by hand in some key positions. And that's why it got it was forgotten in time. But that is the hope, that somehow we take products of this tree rather than the usual continuous limit as we think of fine graining. Somehow it's sticking this tree together in a product sense that has a hope of recovering the continuous limit. I don't know what I'm talking about. Thank you.
Any other questions?